My name is Peter Reiling from the Aspen Institute. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this afternoon's event. Can the global economy prepare for a pandemic? I think we're all waiting for the answer to that one and hope that it's in the affirmative. I'd like to thank Booz Allen Hamilton for sponsoring this particular session as well as multiple sessions throughout the Ideas Fest. And it's my pleasure to turn things over to Heather Burns, Senior Vice President from Booz Allen Hamilton. Heather, over
Great.
To you.
Thanks very much. Welcome, everybody, to our panel this afternoon. We are here to talk about a very, very significant issue that I think you're probably all interested in, or you wouldn't be here. We've all heard of bird flu or avian flu. It's been extremely well discussed in the press over the last few years. And we all know it's extremely significant. The World Health Organization has stated that between 2 and 7 million people could die from a pandemic. And I think even beyond this, millions more would be affected, infected, and global economy and society would be tremendously impacted. In our panel today, we're going to look at the health risks of a pandemic, but we're going to look well beyond that because it is our belief that this is not just a health issue. It's an issue around global security. It's an issue around business, economics, and so forth. So we would like to get into some of those issues. We have with us here two extremely talented and articulate individuals who I think you'll really enjoy listening to. David Nabarro on my right is the United Nations System Coordinator for Avian and Human Influenza. He was appointed to this position, I believe, in 2005
yep.
by Kofi Annan, and I think you're seconded to the UN from WHO.
Yes.
Prior to this posting, Dr. Nabarro worked at World Health Organization, where he was one of the organization's most senior public health experts. In his current position, Dr. Nabarro is responsible for ensuring that the UN system makes an effective and coordinated contribution to the global effort to control the epidemic of an avian influenza. On my left is Dr. Eric Noji, recently retired from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. In his last position at CDC, he was a senior policy advisor for health and national security for congressional and White House affairs. For his entire career, Dr. Noji has been devoted to public health emergencies. And these have been extremely far-reaching, from 9/11 response to Hurricanes Hugo and Katrina to humanitarian crises in Africa. Currently, Dr. Noji is a senior advisor and expert on avian flu and national security in Washington, D.C. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about how this panel is going to work. We will ask Dr. Noji, followed by Dr. Nabarro, to make a brief statement. Then I will ask them a few questions, and I will try very hard to leave enough time for you all to ask questions as well. I know that the panels I've attended, there doesn't seem to have been enough time for the audience to really participate, so we'll do our best on that. So with that, let me turn it over to Eric.
Well, thank you very much, Heather. I'm delighted to be here. I have to say that she's absolutely right. Since the SARS epidemic, most of our work at CDC, not surprisingly, has been devoted to the technical, scientific aspects of surveillance, monitoring, early warning, controlling epidemics, vaccine development. But particularly in the last year or so, I've always been very interested in foreign policy issues and started to see articles of pandemic flu and the close tie between health and national security, articles in Health Affairs, very prestigious journal. And then, of course, when I started seeing front page articles in Wall Street Journal, The Economist, and Business Week, this really started to get me thinking that, my goodness, having been involved in the bioterrorist preparedness issue and now focusing on a naturally occurring epidemic, that this could indeed be one of the great disasters or catastrophes in our country's history. And despite the enormous advances in genomics and proteomics, surveillance, telecommunications, and basic epidemiology that we learn going from house to house. This battle, and I do look upon this as a war. You've got a very, very tricky enemy. I describe this as a complex adaptive virus within a complex adaptive system. And when I think of this complex adaptive system applied to economics, the complex relations between retailers and supply lines of critical materials that have great health impact, transfer of money, a transfer of food, all of which could be disrupted by a major pandemic, where some studies in the social science literature estimate that 30% to 40% of people may not show up to work. And I've given some corporate lectures in the financial analysis sector in New York, and if you just had like five mid-level computer programmers and a stoppage of transatlantic international transfer funds 2 days, that's an enormous amount of financial losses. For the purposes of this session, I'm going to be assuming these factors in our discussion. Due to the highly infectious nature of influenza, efforts at quarantine and isolation, and I won't go through their subtle differences between those terms, will be only partially effective at preventing infection by pandemic influenza, but may reduce the speed of disease spread. And the reason I put that up is some people are very black and white. Some people say those just simply won't work. They will work. Infected individuals may be contagious 1 or 2 days prior to manifesting signs and symptoms of disease. Infection, that just means you've got the bug in you. But it may be a while before you actually manifest the symptoms of disease. And it makes it very difficult to protect your borders, because you'll have people getting off an airplane, crossing a border, and they're not sick. So a significant percentage of those infected will not develop signs and symptoms, yet still will be infectious for a period of time. And this may seriously threaten the efficacy of quarantine and isolation efforts. So when we talk about border security and stopping the enemy, at that point, it's, well, virtually impossible. Third term, and I do a lot of work right now with the Pentagon and our global military infrastructure, and I just got back from Pacific Command in Hawaii, and they use this term containment that, you know, if we can stop the enemy at the source, maybe we can stop the organism from reaching the homeland, the United States. But basically, it's my feeling that containment as currently devised or planned by the military is simply not going to succeed. However, once again, failed containment, even if they do institute these measures, may still delay the international spread by, and I've heard various figures, 1 month, 2 weeks, 2 months. Severe travel restrictions may delay U.S. cases by 1 to 4 weeks. And as I said before, border screening is difficult because persons may transmit infection up to a day before they develop illness. So you have a person, looks fine, and they get sick once they're in the country. But so these containment efforts will delay the arrival, so to speak, of avian influenza, and would buy some time for additional preparatory activities on the part of public health authorities. So once again, I don't say, you know, don't do these things in your area of responsibility to the military. Now, just off the top of my head, I was thinking of political and economic issues just based on history. And I think of Darwinian law, and certainly I'm not an expert in this area, medical doctor, but almost all of the world's, just by statistics, almost all the world's influenza vaccine is produced in nine countries. As you see there, the nine countries. And 40% of the world's supply of interpandemic influenza vaccine is used in countries that don't produce their own vaccine. And in times of crisis, historically, whenever there's a major threat to national survival or the political feeling that that's true, it can be expected that self-preservation is the number one concern, and it's expected that government leaders will nationalize their vaccine production facilities. And I've given lectures on this, and they'll say, well, it never happened in this country, but you just go back 30 years, the United States did that on the threat of an outbreak of the swine flu epidemic in 1976. In fact, because of that, the director of the Centers for Disease Control had to step down, a very traumatic time. Sanofi Pasteur, the only vaccine producer based in the U.S., is, you can see, is only capable of producing so many million vaccines a year, and even in this country would leave 250 million people unvaccinated if a pandemic, even influenza, were to break out. So we're talking about a situation of really being back against the wall medically, public health, economically, socially, financially. And the past, once again, history has shown that government's immediate reaction to outbreaks is usually to quarantine both people and nations. And if an outbreak were to occur, embargoes could be put into place. Which in this age of globalization, the interdependency of nations, any type of embargo is extremely disruptive. The last paragraph there has a profound impact on hospitals, public health departments, the major shortages in all countries of a wide range of commodities, food, medications, soap, paper, light bulbs, gasoline, parts for repairing military equipment, municipal water systems, medications, vaccines, unrelated to the epidemic, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, the number one killers of people in this country. Well, I'm going to end. I was asked to go and use examples from my own personal experience, and the closest I could think of was the period after 9/11. As you all know, the blast attack on the World Trade Center, followed a few weeks later by the anthrax release in the U.S. postal system, and of course my agency, the Centers for Disease Control, would be involved, but we just aren't trained in our epidemiology training for risk communication, communicating with the public. And 50-year history at CDC, polio programs in the 50s, smallpox in the 60s, the HIV epidemics, emerging, re-emerging diseases, you know, fantastic accomplishments. Can you believe it? Not one press conference like you see at the White House in 50 years. We just aren't trained to do that. And the bottom line is we didn't do a very good job. And unless you do that, the genie's out of the bottle. And once rumor's out of the bottle, it's difficult to stop. Efforts to calm the nation's fears spin out of control. New York Times, and every time I would come to go to my office, first in Health and Human Services and then at the White House, that's because the pile of return this call to CNN, BBC, New York Times. That's how we all felt. And it's very difficult to do science and at the same time deal with legitimate public concerns. So I'm going to end my introduction here by challenges for the private sector and working with the Center for Health Transformation. Former Speaker of the House Gingrich, one of his major concerns is we aren't engaging government and non-government organizations and international organizations with the private sector. And I just, you know, put down these as major challenges we're going to face. You know, what should businesses be doing now to maximize readiness to cope if a pandemic happens? That's simply not done by the majority. How should businesses be organized? Ask yourself, if you were a company CEO or a chief operating officer, what are the first 5 or 10 things you would do now? What are the metrics of progress? We don't know what is preparedness. What should we be doing to cue off of decision making? How could you measure whether or not they're working or not? And then I think this was a very good comment by Mr. Gingrich. You know, we know what's wrong, and you read 99% of what's in the medical literature, the disaster management literature, and it's this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. But what we need to come out is meetings like this, or what are actionable items, positive recommendations, as opposed to simply identifying how we're screwing up. And lastly, this was a quote I got out of the Financial Times by a chief executive officer of a multinational corporation. If it's a coffee shop, you close down and just shutter it and absorb the losses. But when you're talking about a worldwide financial network, the premium, the reward, will go to the companies who figure out how to operate in that network, even if a point is significantly impacted. And by impacted, that would be by a catastrophic pandemic influenza crisis. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Noji. Dr. Navarro?
Thank you, Eric. Thank you very much, Heather, for giving me the floor. I mean, I think that Eric Noji, as so often is the case when he speaks, has set out the challenges very, very clearly. And what I want to do now is to see whether I can convince him and convince yourselves that internationally at the moment we are picking up on some of these issues and actually trying to make sure that the global economy is planning properly for a pandemic. I've been given the responsibility, as Heather said, to try to make sure that the United Nations system, which means the political bodies like the Security Council and the General Assembly, the organizations of the UN, like the World Health Organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the United Nations Children's Fund, and about 20 other organizations with fabulous acronyms, and then also our presence within the United Nations, actually in countries. We have offices and teams in more than 110 countries. And my responsibility is to make sure that this system is actually doing what it should do, which is to help the world get ready for a pandemic, to help the global economy and global society to be well enough prepared. Well, first of all, I think Eric's made it clear. The potential for a pandemic to come along and affect our world in the next few years is a real thing. We're not here talking about fantasy. We're talking about something that is real. We've already got one pandemic, HIV, and it took us quite a long time to get organized to approach it as a pandemic issue. We had a big scare in 2003 with SARS, which affected people in 5 countries, killed slightly less than 1,000, and caused, it's believed, to be somewhere in the region of $50 million worth of economic loss. And so we know, those of us working in public health, that there is always this threat of pandemic, likely to be as a result of an organism that moves from the animal kingdom into the human race, and that it's going to have these really substantial social and economic consequences. And in Davos, at the World Economic Forum earlier this year, and some of us were there, we were talking to chief executives of large companies, and they said they had 4 big risks they're worried about at the moment. One, which looks like it's going to come true, is an oil price more than $100 per barrel. The second was major terrorist outrages, causing close down of business. The third was global warming. And the fourth, which didn't come forth in the ranking order, but I'm just saying it fourth, was the threat of a pandemic. And at least two large travel companies are working on the possibility of 10% likelihood per year of pandemic. Don't tell me how they get those figures, because we certainly can't make that sort of prediction. But you can see that large companies, if these are representative, and I believe they are taking this threat very seriously. And so are governments. In September last year, the heads of the ASEAN nations, the countries of Southeast Asia, came together and met with the Secretary General. And they were identifying their concerns to him and their fear of a pandemic resulting from a mutation of the avian influenza virus was put right at the top of their list. And they appealed to the Secretary General, Kofi Annan, to help them. And then shortly afterwards, the President of the United States made an announcement about his concern and said that he was setting up an international partnership on avian and pandemic influenza. So I think the threat is perceived by many in positions of power, in positions of influence, in businesses, as well as in the public sector, to be a serious one. And so in November, the world developed a set of strategies for dealing with the threat of a pandemic, with a particular focus on avian influenza. Countries came together in Geneva, met and hammered out a strategy which is based on two parts. One is trying to stamp out the current outbreak of H5N1 avian influenza, which is in itself the nastiest avian influenza virus we've ever seen, so as to reduce the potential for that virus to mutate to become the pandemic virus. And the second was to encourage all nations everywhere to follow Eric's advice and to get ready to be able to respond to a pandemic in an effective way. Well, we've just reviewed what countries have done, and we find that during the last 6 months, virtually all countries in the world have developed pandemic plans. All countries have undertaken to be transparent with information about what's happening and to tell the World Health Organization if they get strange outbreaks of human illness of an influenza type. Countries have agreed to work together for rapid response and to mobilize cash so that the necessary resources are made available and to initiate training programs for their personnel. We've gone a bit further into these plans, and I'm afraid they're not all as good as the paper looks, and actually going and visiting the countries and going in more detail suggests that probably only a third of these are really viable plans, and less than a third have been put to the test through proper simulations. And there is still some spaces, because the plans are very heavily geared towards the health services, what hospitals will do when pandemic arrives. But as you've heard already, a pandemic will have consequences that go way beyond the hospitals and the health sectors. So working through regional organizations like ASEAN, the European Union, the African Union, we have been trying to get countries to go further with their pandemic plans, to take them around one more circle, perhaps two more circles, to look into greater detail about how they'll deal with rule of law and security, how they'll deal with essential services and utilities down to the light bulbs, how they'll deal with the problems associated with communities being without food or without water, and to really go into the greater detail of the risks that a pandemic can cause. And we need to empower them to do this with simulation exercises, coaching and training, something that several people in this room, including the organization headed up by Mr. Gingrich, have been active in. So there's more to do, but we know there's more to do, and we're going to do it. So let's look in a bit more detail at what these national and regional plans look like. Well, as I've already said, they've got a few holes in them. They're a bit too predicated on health, far too much emphasis on going out and buying Tamiflu, not enough emphasis on protective equipment, social distancing, and the other non-pharmaceutical measures that are important. Most countries recognize that vaccines probably won't be useful for the first 6 months, though many are investing in what they call pre-pandemic vaccines of uncertain utility. Perhaps the biggest difficulty relates to this issue of containment that Eric talked about. There is still a belief, which I'm very pleased to see, that when the pandemic does start, if the virus has a low reproduction rate, it should be possible to apply the fire blanket and to close it down, or at least to delay its spread. And so we've got a major exercise to get countries working together on how to contain a pandemic quickly, within 3 weeks of its arrival. And then we've also been trying to build techniques for rapid response with improved communication between countries so that when pandemic is here, that we've got different countries working together on how to maintain essential infrastructure and services. But still some way to go. I give us about 50% on our progress in that kind of work of looking at the details of this. And so finally, what does it feel like to be in the United Nations watching this happen? Well, firstly, the leadership on this work is not coming from, say, the World Health Organization or even from the United Nations, and that's probably how it should be in this world today. The leadership is coming from governments working together in this international partnership that I've described, but engaging the United Nations. So the UN is folding around the interests, the political interests of countries, rather than staying separate and saying to countries, you've got to come and fit into our way of working. And I'm pleased with that. That's certainly what the Secretary General asked us to try to do. It's a different kind of UN from what we normally show. We've got some excellent example plans from the United States, from Australia, from Vietnam and other countries that we can hold up and say, use these. They've got accountability written into them. They've got action points. They're primarily outside the health sector. We've got media companies now talking to us about how they will be engaged with us from the moment the pandemic starts so that we can work with them to ensure that accurate and reliable messages are sent out at regular intervals through all available media so that people perhaps have a little bit more information than they're usually used to having that will help them to make decisions. We're trying to engage with scientists so that we can move quickly to get better quality diagnostics so that when people are queuing up to get onto an aeroplane, we can quickly test them to see if they're carrying the virus, because that'll make a huge difference, because at the moment we can't easily do that. And we also need to get engaged with the scientists on a number of other key areas. That's coming. We probably need to do more work on that. And then lastly, we're trying to make sure that when the pandemic starts, the world's political leaders will have a mechanism through which they can work together, even if Manhattan is closed down and the United Nations can't work. So I've been working with the General Assembly and the others in the United Nations about creating a system for virtual governance that will mean that we can at least meet together and have countries able to tackle difficult issues like pandemic refugees and so on to get it right. You notice I haven't talked about the chickens who were on Eric's slide. That's a whole different subject. But dealing with the current epizootic of avian influenza, which is now affecting more than 50 countries, well, around 50 countries in the world, give or take. Spain's just got it yesterday. This is a really another huge problem and one that is taxing us all, but that's for next year. Thank you, Heather.
Well, thank you very much. I think that I, to respond to you, do feel a little bit better. On one level, but I would like to ask Eric, first of all, a question that you may feel better about answering given that you're retired from the CDC.
But I might want a contract.
Well, you said you were very honest in the fact that CDC had not done, in your view, an adequate job. Given that this is a fundamentally social, in my view, issue that affects us each individually, our families, and so forth, what should the CDC or what other agencies should be engaged in communicating to the public about what they should expect and how they should respond?
Well, I think that's a good question. Actually, with David about the chicken, I wanted to be an ornithologist when I was in college. I didn't put any wild ducks on there, no. Which I was thinking about doing. to get back to... it's very difficult to explain because a lot of whenever people ask, well, why doesn't the CDC do this or do that and implement these planning programs at the local level? Well, you know, despite the fact that we had a civil war and where we had at that time more of a confederation, each state almost a separate country, we still have laws on the books that CDC has to go through a state health department in states like California and New York with, you know, almost states in themselves, the Los Angeles County and New York. We just, our CDC cannot impose their work, their protocols, their recommendations. Most CDC has such enormous respect that in many cases these are done.
Is there another organization that should be playing that role?
Well, we do have organizations, I call them professional guilds, like the American Medical Association, American Public Health Association, NACHO, National Association of City and County Health Officers, City and Territorial Epidemiologists, and these are a way of getting what we do and scientifically getting it to the practitioners. Mm-hmm. Because one of our concerns was that our policies and our plans were, we want them based, informed by science. And you're mentioning the panic and the political influence on the decisions that are made. When I was at WHO and working with David Heyman, and you know, do we report this disease in Somalia or disease which may destroy the economy if it's tourism related? So you know, it's always a balance. But
okay, well, thank you, Dr. Nabarro. My next question is for you. When we were exchanging email to prepare for this session, you described yourself in a manner that I found very intriguing, which I wanted to know more about, which is you said that you were a stovepipe buster. Mm-hmm. And the reason I found that intriguing was that this pandemic or threat is, as we've discussed, far more than a health issue. And even if there were a vaccine, which we don't think there will be, that would be effective, or enough of it, if the geopolitical structure can't work effectively, how effective will we be in responding to the virus? Could you comment on that, particularly your skill at busting stovepipes?
Well, there are kind of two parts to this, really. The first is that in the modern world, we depend hugely on cooperation between nation states. It's how the place is set up, really. And so in most of our systems that we have for trying to get action on dealing with a difficult issue, we require governments, represented usually by ministers, to come together and agree that they're going to act. But there's a really excellent new feature of the world now compared with what it was about 30 years ago when I started out on my professional career. We have incredibly exciting, intricate networks. Think back to that picture that Eric showed of the networks going across the world. These are networks. They're not just professional networks. They're networks linked through media, linked through religious affiliation, linked through simply people liking the same pop artists, using cell phones, using internet, using a whole stack of other techniques that have become available to us because we've got used to working outside the normal vertical channels of social organization in which we're engaged. And I believe the combination of those networks that are driven increasingly by people alongside some of the more rigid linkages between governments is beginning to shake, to create a little bit more room for maneuver in the sort of international system in which we're working with this kind of threat. Remember, this is not really a political threat of the kind that we're so used to dealing with, that colleagues here who I've heard talking this morning have been spending their lives working on. This is a threat to the whole of humanity, and one that requires, therefore, the whole of humanity to get organized. But the sorts of organization we need to deal with this kind of threat are not standard one person in top in command and control and everybody following orders type of thinking. Instead, we have to think of forms of social organization in which groups who normally work separately in the stovepipes, as I call them, whether they're organized inside government or organized inside companies, or organized inside religion or civil society, to get them to work much more together in a collaborative way for common objectives. The usual way that we work towards that is through exhortation, using kind of moral arguments. Sometimes we buy it using cash. It doesn't usually work very well. But I think given the networking that is available in the world in which we live, there is much more opportunity for getting people to see working together as a utilitarian goal rather than simply something that's morally desirable. And I certainly have noticed this in the way in which countries of Southeast Asia, at all levels, particularly Vietnam, Thailand, which are my two mega examples, have been working on this issue. I saw it earlier this week in Egypt, the way in which media, internet, cell phone technology, as well as the normal tools of the state, were working together to bring about change. And I would like to feel that it is through those sorts of approaches that we can break down the stovepipes in order to get an effective response. Because if we don't break down the stovepipes, we will certainly get hit by this thing big. And there, I don't even need to mention the examples close to home of where the stovepipes led to poor communication and poor response to a major disaster recently.
Thank you very much. I'd actually like to go closer to home right now because we've talked a lot about responses at political and a fairly high institutional level.
Yeah.
I don't hear a lot about families and families planning for a response to this, whereas I think the reality is that's where it's going to hit hard, and I think most of the confusion, panic, and lack of a clear plan will be manifested. I'm wondering for both of you, what do you think we should be doing to address that, and where should families be turning to prepare themselves, develop their own plan if this does occur?
Well, one positive step as a result of our experience in the anthrax crisis and in SARS was CDC now has an excellent website on bioterrorism, earthquakes, tsunamis, radiation disasters like Chernobyl. Actually, that occurred the month I came to CDC. Talk about transparency. World didn't find out about that for quite a while. The CDC website, for the first time, I've actually seen it stratified in advice for businesses, advice for big businesses, small businesses, families, travel industry, agricultural industry, and that's been a big recognition by CDC that they just can't give one standard fits all sort of advice. But the tough challenge is going to be how to, because not everyone has access to internet and is that savvy with computers. And the only way, CDC only has a limited number of personnel, and it's going to be basically at the city, county health level and almost door-to-door meeting with the neighborhood community representatives. But it's possible, because the only way, Dr. Nabarro mentioned that, in the absence of a vaccine or in the absence of a drug that will kill avian influenza, we're going to have to be using what are non-medical countermeasures, which harkens back in time to classic public health measures, what is now called social separation. I mean, where is disease transmitted? If you look at the literature, kids who are close together are just tremendous spreaders of disease. Well, you may have to stagger a school schedule. Workers in factories, they may have to work from midnight to 8 shift, 8 to 12. Large gatherings like Sunday's World Cup championship. Well, I don't think that would work. Canceling major gatherings like that. But these are not new things. I went to the FEMA, Federal Emergency Management. Their predecessor organizations were in charge of civil defense, which is a term we don't use too much. But in the 50s, that was preparing for the threat at that time. Massive nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union, and almost all the measures required citizen buy-in. I mean, sheltering, changing their work schedule, their educational schedule. You had a person assigned to each neighborhood who would walk around. You know, a lot of what I see now is reinventing the wheel, because we did that in the 50s and 60s with the nuclear threat. You go back to World War II and civil defense when it was the concern of Japanese or German actual threats to the American mainland. And then I think a great example is in London. I don't know whether Dr. Nabarro is old enough to remember, but children, I mean, being evacuated from London to not be subject to the Blitz. A lot of what we're planning on is going to require a lot of individual cooperation at the community level and the individual household level.
Okay,
to
great.
Work.
Do you want to comment?
Just to agreeing 100%. All praise to Michael Levitt, the Secretary of Health and Human Services here, who has not shied away from going on television and explaining that much of this will have to be done at the household level. He's indicated that if you want to avoid an infectious disease, you stay at home and you don't meet people. So you need enough supplies at home so that you can go through the peak, and then you need to be sure that you practice social separation or distancing, as Eric has said. And I think this is excellent advice. And when we look at history, this is probably the thing that's going to have the greatest positive impact. I see signs in this country that churches and community groups are beginning to focus on what's involved. And you mentioned the word panic. I think people panic. I don't like using the word panic, but I think they make decisions that are not very rational in their own rationality when they have a lack of knowledge and understanding as to what to do. I think there's much greater recognition now than there was 3 or 4 months ago in this country, that the government, both centre and local, is taking this issue seriously, and that people can begin to trust that their government will make decisions on their behalf. And so my own belief, but it's still got to be tested, is that the preparations that are being done, both at local level as well as at the national level, are beginning to do what is necessary, which is to reassure people that there will be fairly clear instructions as to what they should do. But test us more on this, Heather, because, one's often overly optimistic in a position like mine, and perhaps we need to go into this in more detail.
Thanks.
That whole issue of individual family, their role in this. I mean, we used to give out just blithely, okay, quarantine, or your family should be isolated. Well, what if mom is at work and dad is at work and the kids are at school? Are you going to isolate all three of them?
Or what if mom is on a business trip in Seattle and back in Washington the infection, you know, the virus is in the household? Does she come home, or does she stay in Seattle so she's okay? Which brings me to my final question, and then I'm going to open it up to the floor. We don't hear much about the ethics around pandemic. And I think, though, that when if we put ourselves in the actual position of needing to deal with a pandemic, there's some pretty tough decisions that we as individuals in a society are going to have to make. Who gets treatment first? Who gets into the hospital? Do you set up a treatment center at Walmart, for instance? Who goes to work? Who stays home? When we did a recent simulation, a number of the participants were looking to the government for help on sorting through those sorts of questions. Who do you think is responsible, and do you have any advice on how we should start thinking about that?
Well, just domestically, you know, people say, you know, the government should never be involved in those issues of life and death, and who should get the drug and who should get the vaccine. That's just not something we do in this country traditionally, historically. But that's not true. Even if you look at influenza, in a normal season, or people don't realize in a normal season we may have 40, 50,000 people die just at a normal rate, but we do triage our limited supply. we might be first to go to the elderly over the age 65 or elderly with predisposing heart disease, lung disease, children under the age of such and such. And then okay, 3 months later, our supply is adequate. We can now lower the age rate to workers and who have a chronic disease. At least with infectious disease, we do that. We do make recommendations as to who should get this and what is the criteria. I haven't seen for pandemic avian influenza for who should get Tamiflu first. I've read a lot of things, but whether that's in the president's national plan, I'm simply not sure.
In public health, we have to make decisions all the time to do with protecting people, and those often require us to cause some restriction on movement or even on earning opportunities for groups of people. In this issue, we're making similar operational decisions, and we're doing it now all the time. This is supposed to be off, but it's not off. That's from the Minister of Health of Spain, who's going to ring me saying what to do about her problem. We'll do it afterwards. Because she's got an avian flu arrived yesterday, you see. So, and I mean, she's going to have to deal with some difficult ethical issues because she's got this bird that's arrived, and they're going to have to create an exclusion zone, and they have to decide, are they going to require the culling of a large number of birds in the vicinity, which will lead to people losing their livelihoods? And all the time you're having to make these trade-offs between the interests of the whole versus the interests of a few. We're doing it now. I was doing it with the Egyptian Prime Minister on Monday, exactly that kind of stuff. Now, we have to, I think, be aware that these operational decisions do require ethical underpinning. And we rely on public health practitioners informed by legislators to get the ethical balance right. But I think it's tricky, and I think Eric has just pointed out that sometimes there's a sort of default that we're expected to do it without necessarily doing it in an explicit way. And I'm happy to say that people in the Health and Human Services here, together with a number of international experts, are now moving forward with a sequence of really careful ethical discussions on this issue, a major one which takes place towards the end of July, and kind of we need it. So I think it's a very relevant issue to bring up.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn it to the audience. Are there any questions? Yes.
That's right.
We'll get to you next. Thanks.
That's right.
Oh, I'm sorry. There's the mic. The light was blinding me.
On the household level, question on the household level, what's the response to be if, in fact, a reliable vaccine won't be available for, say, 6 months, what can an average household do? Is there any antiviral medication commercially available now that we could have that might forestall that avian?
It's the incredibly insidious thing about the virus. We know a lot, but we don't know a lot. In fact, all the stockpiling, we don't know how effective Tamiflu would be. Probably would be a little bit, but if I said buy some, I would be giving bad advice. We don't know. For H5N1.
There's a mic over here if people want to.
And there's a mic over on the other side, and I apologize. The only point was I understand the reason for the mics is just so everybody can hear. So
right.
I think everybody could hear because you could speak very clearly. Sam Perry, I'm doing some work at Stanford around disaster preparation, and I'm actually quite surprised about where we're going with the panel right now. I would interpret, and I don't really know where to start, I'd interpret Michael Levitt's comment as very candid and in a very good way of saying it's up to the governments. If you look back to 1918, we had at that point a very close-knit communities where you had neighborhood captains for every neighborhood. You have a very different social structure, and yet you still had open pit graves, mass graves, because they couldn't simply handle the number of people who are dying. In this state, in Colorado, when you talk about quarantine, they're talking about publishing people's names in newspapers of houses that you don't want to go to, which is a little different from the way our laws are now. which involves question one is how do we anticipate handling some of those things in reality in our current sitting? And the second question is just related to that. This is just on a local level, keeping in mind that each health officer in this country of 5,500, I think, counties nationwide, is a prince, king, whatever, unto themselves in that county. And I'm aware in the Bay Area of at least one health officer who said that if there were a dead migratory bird that fell in this county, he would do nothing from avian flu, found to be from avian flu, in front of a group of people. So there are issues related to this localness is the big point. And how do you anticipate going from talking to a prime minister is one thing, or a president, but going on the local level, which is not only this country, but everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Anybody want to field that one?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, what you've said, I think, is both self-evident, but also at the same time, often forgotten. And probably in my own statements, I insufficiently stressed the importance of there being full engagement of community organizations in preparedness work. I think that by and large, again, most governments are a little wary of, right from the beginning, engaging community groups in preparedness work. But certainly in Vietnam, in Thailand, in Laos, to a lesser extent in Indonesia, and in parts of China, I have seen that being done, because these countries, when they were either threatened by SARS or affected by SARS, realized that if they didn't engage local groups, they got into real trouble. And I suppose it's necessary, perhaps, and thank you for your point, for us to be all the time recognizing we've got to work on both sides, with the national leaders, but also at the neighborhood level, particularly because we don't have social organization at the neighborhood level that easily deals with these issues. I'm sorry, I haven't answered. I've just simply said probably we need to do more.
Actually, that's going to be, I don't know when it's going to be published, but much of the literature on the impact of 1918, Spanish influenza, the cities that they looked at were the cities with the local health officers, basically, and local authorities and the mayor didn't do very good jobs. San Francisco, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and recent modeling, and now people are saying that we're having an epidemic modeling now, but there's going to be a publication on where they looked at cities which the local health authorities did a pretty good job, at Atlanta, St. Louis, Milwaukee, and just substantially lower mortality and severity of illness and economic loss, and if you compare the two, pretty significant. And what is the significance of that? Well, there are things that we can do. Many people just throw up their arms and say, that has pretty profound policy implications that we may not see the need for tremendous surge capacity. Hospitals may not be overrun by lots and lots of patients, and that's going to be because so much of our work, and so we've spent so much money on preparing for that. A study like that, which is going to come out, will be very interesting.
Great, thank you.
I came in a couple minutes late, so you may have mentioned this in the beginning, but given that the CDC recently announced at least one confirmed case of human-to-human transmission of avian flu in a family in Indonesia, I believe it was, if you all were betting men, what would you bet would be the time frame for a worldwide pandemic? 3 years, 5 years, 7 years? I mean, what are we looking at in terms of science's best guess at this point?
I haven't worked for CDC now, and I'll leave to the global level.
The case in Karo in northern Sumatra, where there was human-to-human-to-human transmission, that's the third instance that we documented of human-to-human transmission of H5N1. There was some documentation from Hong Kong in 1997 or 98. I can't remember when. So it's not the first. I'm sufficiently exercised myself that I am very personally frustrated that we're not moving faster with international pandemic preparedness. I'm not a betting man, but I worry about the next 12 months.
Okay. Thank you.
Two questions, if I may. We all witnessed the unfortunate events in New Orleans, the breakdown of society and the rules of society. With all the planning that we're talking about, without communications, you lose a few key links in the governmental plan, and do you see social order breaking down? Secondly, you talk about social separation. How long can we be socially separated, and how long does a pandemic take to run its course or get under control?
Well, I'll tell you, unlike a normal flu season, it's pretty much a few months, a pandemic H5N1 season could be a year and a half, 2 years. So it's, when you ask, well, how long can people be separated? You know, we're not talking about it, just a few months. And it goes in waves. You'll have a wave of deaths, and then things settle down, and boom, it comes back again. You know, one thing about Katrina, which was actually very depressing for me, because my whole career in disaster and emergency management, and the you know, we'd always thought, you know, local preparation, drills, what happened, the importance of communications. The government spent millions of dollars on modeling the impact of a hurricane of every strength imaginable, the rise of water, the strength of the dikes, and the fact that one thing that I've learned is, you know, just knowing how to do something doesn't guarantee that it's going to be done. And if it's in the plans, not necessarily going to be done. There's another step beyond that. I was working with WHO as working as the chief medical officer in the Turkey earthquake. Turkey has better earthquake regulations than the U.S. I mean, just first rate. But there was corruption in individual contracting of buildings. The designs were not used. Cheap material was substituted. And so there's all these factors that go into good outcomes. And Katrina is certainly going to have a lot of lessons over a lot of our assumptions that simply doing drills, and they had a drill a month before the hurricane, and they've had drills that almost were the identical situation, and it still didn't seem to have made a big impact.
I'm afraid we only have time for one more question. I'm sorry.
My name is Brian Zwan. I have two questions, one on the pre-testing and one on vaccination. For the United States, we think that the gateways into the U.S., let's say from Asia or other places, might be the entrance points where infection can come in. And so the question on pre-testing is, will it be done here at the gateways, or will it be done overseas? And the pre-testing, is it something that's like a nasal swab or something where you get immediate indication whether there's an infection? On vaccination, from both of your perspectives, and you haven't spoken much about a effective vaccination, is your thoughts on vaccinations because, or the lack of an effective one, because one, we're currently the sources to produce the vaccine is difficult to manufacture in quantity, or is it the adaptive nature of the virus that is problematic and troublesome in terms of creating effective vaccination today?
Good, thanks. Quick answers.
I think it's both. I think it's both. I said that you've got a very adaptable virus. So on the one hand,